science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Hey, Alan. How's it going?
Hi, Lillian. It's going very well. Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. This is my first time chatting with you, so we'll see how this goes,
We will.
Yeah. All right.
No pressure.
On either side,
normally the boys just talk through it, so we'll see. They're here to help me out anyway. Our first story for Dear Science is about how two new studies have been released detailing two separate ways that scientists have managed to edit DNA and potentially change the building blocks for life itself.
Yeah.
So the first study was posted in the Journal of Nature and highlights a process where base pairs in DNA can be edited. How do they do that?
Okay, so you're right. There's two studies, one study looking at DNA, the other one looking at RNA. And one was published in Nature, the other one's published in Science. And so this is straight hot off the press. And the fact that they're two very, very similar processes really attests to its importance. So as listeners may or may not know, DNA is made up of, amongst other things, four bases. And the order that those bases are found in the DNA molecule basically is your blueprint for life, essentially. So it makes you what you are. And so the four bases are adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, or A, T, G, and C. And the amazing thing about the DNA molecule is that it has this double helix form, and it's all held together by the fact that these base pairs always pair in one particular way. So the A base always goes with the T base, and the G base always goes with the C base. Okay, so and it's the ordering of these A, T, G, and C that basically, as I say, is your blueprint for life. So if you get those out of order, then what you get is a mutation. And you never want your DNA mutated, obviously, because that gives bad instructions to the rest of the body, and you know, and then you get cancer, et cetera, et cetera. So you get sort of genetic diseases as a result of these mutations.
Right.
So, short story long. So what can happen in nature, and it can happen unaided, is that one of these bases, the cytosine base, can actually undergo a reaction that turns it into the T base. And that's not good.
Right.
Okay, because that's going to bugger up all of the pairing. So basically, your C base, which is of one shape, then turns into a T base, which is of another shape that can't pair with the correct base. Okay, so the T's always go.
And then that occurs over and over again.
Right, yes. And then that will be replicated, because that's what DNA does. So it gets replicated. And you're right. So that's going to happen over and over again. And in fact, this happens spontaneously, apparently every day, about 100 to 500 times per cell in every human being. Okay, so this is quite a common reaction that can occur. And the body's got ways of dealing with mutations of DNA. But obviously, what would be a good idea? So what happens is, if the C turns into a T, then instead of having GC pairs, you can have AT pairs. Okay, and that's going to bugger everything up. So what these guys have done, basically, at both MIT and Harvard, of course, is that they have managed to find a way to turn the AT pairs back into GC pairs. Okay, so you can take these mutated bases, essentially, and turn them back into what they should have been in the first place.
What?
Yeah, I know. It really is quite extraordinary what they can do these days. On a molecular level, it's just quite amazing.
Okay, I'm just getting my mind around this. So you're saying that they're dealing with already formed mutations?
Yes, yeah.
They're not sort of creating mutations and fixing them?
No. So they're basically creating the machinery whereby, if you've got this spontaneous mutation that's happened and your GCs have turned into ATs, then what they can do is they can specifically target those ATs and turn them back into GCs, as they should have been.
Just undoing bad things.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And it really does boggle the mind, the sort of stuff that they can do.
Especially considering it took, 15 years to map the first human genome?
Yes, I know, yes. Yeah.
Just playing with genes?
And it's only, you know, we've only known the structure of DNA since, 1953, whenever it was. So, you know, only sort of 60-odd years. And now you can do all of these amazing things with it. So
can I ask what this does mean for genetic diseases such as Huntington's?
Well, I guess if they can find, you know, the molecular basis for that mutation, then potentially, you know, but you don't want to sort of say too with too much certainty, they could perhaps look at this as being a treatment for genetic disorders. You know, it's one possible way of dealing with genetic disorders.
Does it then remove that, you know, mutation forevermore?
Yeah, well, it's not going to stop it happening again because they can happen spontaneously, but it can reverse, you know, if this mutation has got through all of the body's defences to deal with mutations, then it can reverse that and then it will be... you know, they'll make copies and copies and copies of it. And
then that should pass for the next generation at least.
Yeah, essentially, yes. Yeah, yeah, that's my understanding anyway. So
very, very interesting. Yeah. Science. Very
science,
clever.
Science indeed, yeah, yeah. But the fundamental basis of it is quite simple. It's a very sort of simple reaction that the C-base undergoes, that cytosine undergoes. It just loses a particular group and then that makes it look like, for the body, the other... base pairs, so right. it's all to do with shape, and it's very simple. Potential, well, yeah, I guess, yeah, simple on a chemistry basis, I guess. Which
can you describe how they do it literally? Like do they? Is it like a pair of scissors? And they go
well. again, my understanding is that they're using CRISPR technology, which is the big thing in gene editing now. So,
and can you explain CRISPR a little bit?
Well, it allows you basically to sort of chop out bits of genes or chop out bits of DNA or whatever, again, at specific places.
So CRISPR is separate and different to these studies?
Well, this is an application, I guess, of CRISPR because you've got to have some sort of target for CRISPR to work at. And right. So this, they basically put this machine at the end of the CRISPR process, essentially, that is going to be able to take these ATs back to the GC. So it's all interlinked.
ATs back to the GC.
Indeed, yeah.
Or, I like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So
someone's already writing a song with that as the hook.
But somebody's going to get a Nobel Prize for this soonish, probably. Right, right. This whole CRISPR.
Where did
thing.
It begin? Do you know?
Yeah, it began in I think Harvard. I think opposite sides of the US. I think somebody at Stanford and somebody at Harvard. But the problem is that there's sort of a lawsuit going on with the patents for CRISPR. So. Mm. They won't give a Nobel Prize for this until they have this whole sort of priority thing sorted out. But, you know, it's a phenomenal thing, and somebody will get the Nobel Prize for it. It's just a matter of who. And whoever does, there's going to be all sorts of bitching and moaning, I guess.
Well, and also, I guess with this, I mean, not to dismiss the Nobel Prize, it's incredible, but the ethical issues regarding this are quite huge, isn't it?
Yep. Yep, and you can guarantee that all of these studies that are being done have to go through ethics committees anyway. So, you know, it's as ethical as it can get, I suppose.
Doesn't this kind of open the door to, you know, fixing like issues such as not great eyesight or minor mutations like that are not necessarily life threatening?
Yeah, but we've had sort of ability to do these sorts of things, you know, to genetically engineer things for quite some time now, and you know, there's been those questions have been around for 10, 20, 30 years probably with genetic engineering as well. So that's all that this is. It's just a better way of doing it, I guess. So, yeah.
All right, next story.
The boys are quiet.
Next story. no questions there.
I just heard a weird noise. Oh. Couldn't pin where it was. Got very distracted.
Okay. So for the next story, we have a piece of history.
It is.
Ivy Mike was the code name for the first full-scale thermonuclear detonation, which happened 65 years ago today.
Indeed.
First question, what's the difference between a regular nuclear detonation and a thermonuclear detonation?
Okay, so this is all to do with fission versus fusion. So, we have to get into chemistry and nuclear physics and stuff like that. But, you know, an atom is made up of a nucleus and all the electrons that surround the atom.
Yes, I do know that.
There we go. Okay. So, the nucleus is made up of protons and neutrons. And you can have anywhere of the known elements, you can have one proton all the way up to 118 protons. That's all that we know at the moment.
I didn't know that.
And once the nucleus gets to a particular size... and that's around about 92 protons, there or thereabouts, then it can undergo a reaction called fission, okay? And fission means that you're splitting the nucleus, not in half, but you're splitting it into smaller bits, okay? And when this happens, you give out enormous amounts of energy, enormous amounts. And That is that's fission, and that's what the first atomic bomb was. Okay, so these were fission bombs, the ones that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so they relied essentially on a chain reaction that gets going in a sample of uranium. So not all of the isotopes are fissionable. Not all of them sort of spontaneously undergo these reactions. But the ones that are amongst others, uranium or plutonium. And they, as I say, they can be induced to fall apart essentially into smaller elements. Well, they end up as smaller elements and giving out enormous amounts of energy. Now, the bomb that we're talking about today, Ivy Mike, that was on Eniwetok Atoll in the Marshall Islands, that's essentially the reverse. This is a fusion reaction, or as it's called, a hydrogen bomb. And so what you're doing there is, instead of breaking apart big nuclei, you're taking tiny nuclei and you're forcing them together to fuse, okay? And so particularly what they were doing here, the reason they call it a hydrogen bomb is because hydrogen's used as the fuel. You're essentially taking hydrogen nuclei, or deuterium, which is the same thing, plus one neutron, and you're forcing them to go together and form helium nuclei. And when you do that, you get even more energy out than what you get from the fission process. Okay,
so it's bigger.
It is bigger. So fusion is the way that the sun, our sun, and all of the other suns, stars in the universe work. Okay, and in order to get fusion going, you need enormously high temperatures, enormously high pressures. It's really not a simple reaction to do. And so, in fact, in order to get a hydrogen bomb to go at that stage, they needed an atomic bomb to set it off initially. So it's essentially two bombs. So you get the atomic bomb, and then you get the that sets off the fusion bomb, the hydrogen bomb, and so
it's a double
whammy essentially. And the problem with fusion is that you get a lot of radioactive byproducts. Okay, so fission. So the problem with fission is that you get radioactive byproducts, and so, you know, places are rendered uninhabitable for long time after you do these things there. Fusion is very clean. Okay, so a fusion reaction is very, very clean. If you can get a fusion reaction to go in the absence of it having to be started by a fission reaction,
right,
then you've got potentially limitless energy. And so people are looking at, enormous scientific institutions are looking at trying to get fusion as a potential source for energy. So they're building a fusion reactor, at least in southern France, and that was meant to be running in around about this year, I think. But they've put that back till God knows when, because just the logistics of it, the logistics of having to keep such incredibly high temperatures contained somehow, and I'm buggered if I know how they do that, but they've got this reactor that supposedly could do that. Obviously, in order to sort of power it up, you've got to use enormous amounts of energy anyway, but what you get out
at the end of it is
more than what you put in.
Minus the radioactive.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
So this is possibly a good?
Well, yes. I mean, if humankind wasn't so frickin' stupid and turned all of this amazing technology into bombs, you know, rather than using it for good, then, potentially, yes. I mean, if everybody got together, we'd probably got the technology to be able to do this. But, you know, not everybody gets together, sadly. So
I was going to say, I saw on the Wikipedia page about Ivy Mike that back then, what was it, 1952?
52. Yep.
They were saying that because it was so complex then, that they thought they'd never be able to make a bomb that they'd be able to drop or launch on a missile, because they had to place it and then run away.
Yes,
away, but then set it off. But I mean, this is just normal for nuclear warheads now. You can just
yes, indeed. And the bomb itself was 82 tons, so you're not going to get a plane to carry that in a hurry. But you're right, you know, they managed to work out the logistics of how to get these things to go, and you're right, now, you know, all the submarines and everything, they've all got
I'm going to read my not so fun facts about the Ivy Mike bomb. I've done some research. I'm very interested. There's this website called Nuke Map, which basically means you can plant not literally, but it shows you where you can put a bomb that someone's made or country's made. So it's got all these different bombs that different countries have made, and Ivy Mike's one of them. You can place it anywhere in the world, and I placed it on Auckland just to see what would happen. And apparently, this is terrifying. Estimated fatalities would be around 430,000. Jeez. Which is absurd. Even for, I mean, this is just Auckland. Imagine dropping this in the US or Manhattan or LA, where the population density is a lot smaller.
Yeah.
Third degree burns would go as far as Silverdale up north and as far south as Papakura. And it'd go right out to Pihar and Mirawai. Half of Waiheke Island would have third degree burns.
Yeah.
I mean, this is absurd.
Well, the actual bomb itself, it just vaporized an island in the atoll, in the Eniwetok atoll, where they let it off. So there was an island there, they put it on it, and then it's gone. You can see it on Google Maps.
Where did the island go?
Into the atmosphere, pretty much.
It completely
vaporized.
What you're saying to Ruben and I is they vaped an island.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yep. Which I don't think is something we should laugh about, really.
Yeah, no, not really.
No.
Ecological effects of that.
Well, this is the weird thing, because they started decontaminating the island. Obviously, they got all the population off, which is another story in itself. But then, yeah, I know. And then, so they started cleaning up in 1977. That took 3 years. And then they started re-inhabiting parts of the island, which they say are now safe. And they've got a big dump there, which has got a big concrete bunker, and apparently that's busy deteriorating or something. So that holds a lot of the radioactive soil and stuff that was still there. So they went and sort of scooped that up.
So even though it is fusion that's the safer one or the cleaner one?
No, the fission. The fusion is the cleaner. God, yeah, the fusion's the cleaner one. But they did have a sum total of 43 nuclear tests on this particular atoll.
Oh, my God.
So, and the majority of those were fission bombs.
Because I didn't realize it was inhabited before, so they had to take the population off this.
Apparently inhabited since before 1000 BC, apparently. So people have been there for a long time, and then all of a sudden they just come along and they get booted off, and it's poor.
Fucked.
Yeah, Diego Garcia is another example of that, but we won't go there. That's an appalling story.
What wasn't also the name of the bikini talk that comes from it?
Yep. Bikini
splitting
atoll.
Yeah.
And again, that's not too far away from Eniwetok as well. It's in the Marshall Islands as well.
So who were conducting these tests?
Americans.
Typical.
I saw in the news the other day that the Brits wanted to use, God, was it Campbell Island or the Auckland Islands? They wanted to do their hydrogen bomb tests down
right
there.
Right now. Yeah. We're talking now.
No. This was in 1955, okay. I think. And Sid Holland, to his credit, said no. So the Brits had been doing their tests in Australia, and then the Aussies sort of kicked up a stink and they didn't want them doing hydrogen bomb tests there. And so the Brits were looking around for possible places. And apparently, God, it was the Auckland Islands or one of those ones down south. And they wanted us to let them use that. And eventually they ended up using Christmas Island, I think. So,
yeah, do you think these other islands got the chance to say no?
I doubt it. Yeah. Yes.
Any other?
No, can we move on? I'm really sad now.
Right, okay, well.
this is so depressing.
Sorry, guys.
Lucky you weren't on the island. Lucky you weren't removed from the island. All right, next story. Last story for our Dear Science segment is what Ellen has described as a puff piece. And when you sent that in the email, I asked what that meant. But we'll find out.
Actually, it's quite appropriate when I think about it. That's a good pun, actually.
Yes,
I didn't even realise that. No, I didn't even realise that.
So a new study finds that cannabis users have 20% more sex than non-cannabis users.
Mm-hmm.
And there is the puff pun. What are your thoughts on this, Ellen?
Well, I certainly remember one of my colleagues saying that surveys are not science, but we...
Yeah, and I mean, there was... The survey said that... I mean, the amount of sex that these people that they surveyed were having was quite low anyway.
Well, it depends on what you mean by low, I guess. But yeah.
Well, it's seven times a month.
A month, yes.
That was
So the basically
highest rate for women who were cannabis smokers.
Daily smokers, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, let me explain the study a bit,
There's really not that much to explain. I mean, they just, surveyed a bunch of people, and the questions were basically, how many times have you had heterosexual intercourse in the last 4 weeks? And
so a limited study.
Yes. And how many times you've smoked dope over the past year, essentially. So... they found that, as you say, the best rates of the highest rates of sex were women who were daily dope smokers. So they had, I think, 7.1 acts of sex in the last 4 weeks, compared with an average of 6 for the non-dope smokers. And for guys, it was something like 6.9 versus 5.8, something like that. So it equates to around about 20% more sex if you're a dope smoker. However, they were at pains to then say that there's no cause, and there's not necessarily a causal link between the two. And the thing that really gets me about stuff like this is the stuff that gets reported in the media. All of these sort of surveys, this is the stuff that gets the headlines. And is it really science? I mean, it was done at Stanford, for goodness sake, so you'd imagine hopefully they've got all their statistics and shit and everything all sorted. But really,
so should we be talking about it? Was that what you're that's saying?
I chose the story, didn't I?
So, are we looking at it critically, though? We're going to talk about the shortcomings of the study? Or?
Well, no, I'm just sort of putting it out there. As I said, it is a puff piece, you know, and sadly, the media these days are too full of puff pieces. And I think, if I may say so, I think it reached the absolute nadir the other day when there was an article on the Herald Online saying, are you wiping your bum wrong?
I didn't read it, though.
I didn't read it either. No. But
I saw that David Slack said that actually, apparently, we're supposed to be using the Herald to wipe our bum. that was the conclusion.
Well, this was the electronic version, so that'd be difficult, but yeah.
My question for you, Ellen, really quickly, is was this, were they looking back and saying, did they ask about their month, or were they doing it over the period of a month?
That's a good question. They didn't really make that clear. Yes.
I mean, the ability of people to recall those sorts of things, especially not down-talking marijuana users or anything, but I feel like the ability to recall exactly the exact amount of times you'd smoked in a year retrospectively would be kind of hard.
I think you're right. But, you know.
We are going to get some texts, I tell you what.
We do have a text, actually.
Oh, yay.
And it's quite a nice one, Alan, so we might finish on it.
Okay.
It says, the guy talking about the neutrons and the DNA reverse mutation stuff, .. is he single?
Oh.
No.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, thank you for coming in, Alan.
Okay.
It was very, very interesting.
Absolute
and
pleasure.
We'll talk to you next week.
Surely, we'll do.
We will be back shortly.
See y'all.
That was Dear Science.
Hey, what's your name? You got a durry? Dart? A ciggy? A hairy rag?
You mean a death stick? Nah, mate, take a hoon on this cosmic e-cig.
I've been living all wrong.
Vaping. It's better for you and for your bank balance. Cosmic's got you covered with top quality e-cigs and liquids, the best prices in town and great service. Because there's a bit to know and they're here to help. Pop into Cosmic on High Street, K Road or online at cosmicnz.co.nz. Best prices, best service, always.
Oh, it's 2:00. Back on the Good Foot's about to start.
No, wait. What are you doing? I'm not wearing any shoes.
Huh?
Oh no, it's too late. The Salacious Mix are calling crews. It's too much. I can't not dance. It's only a matter of time before my poor unprotected feet are ground down to wet chalky nubs and I'm left totally footless.
I mean, I can just turn off the radio.
No, I like this song.
Back on the Good Foot, dousing you in solid soul toe tappers, rocksteady groovers, and filthy funk freakouts every Sunday from 2 to 4 with your delightful hosts, Tina Turntables and Mr. Crawley. Back on the Good Foot, proudly presented by Auckland's Shoemaster Generals, Pat Menzies. They've got your dancing shoes sorted and anything else your good feet could wish for. Walk on down to the Canterbury Arcade at 174 Queen Street, get on up to their new store in St. Kevin's Arcade on K Road, or pop online to patmenziesshoes.co.nz.
Oh man, I just realised Good Foot and it's a shoe shop. That's classic. Good job, sales team.
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
On Wednesdays, we speak with Tracy Martin from New Zealand First, but we haven't managed to do that for the past few weeks as negotiations went on and announcements were made, and the new government was basically quite busy. Today, I managed to speak with Tracy earlier this morning, but she indicated this might be the last time we're able to do this. So next week, we will have someone new. I talked to Tracy about the negotiations and some of the new policy announcements that have been made. Well, first of all, congrats on getting into Parliament.
Thank you, yes, because it was a pretty hard election. There was no guarantees, that's for sure.
That's right. The negotiations went on for some time. How was that? What was the kind of mood within New Zealand First, and how was everyone after the negotiations?
Well, those of us that that took a sort of a lead role. I mean, because they actually didn't go on for that long. The meetings that we had to go through every sort of piece of policy that we were hoping to promote, and obviously we had a meeting with one side, national on one side, and then we had a meeting with Labor on the other. So we were doing double meetings on every area of policy. They are 12 days. But it was a very intense 12 days. So we would have four of those meetings each day. They would be 2 to 2.5 hours long. It then took another 2 to 3 hours to transcribe the minutes. So, you know, they were big days. And those of us that were sort of in the lead on that were, well, pretty pretty tired by the end of it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So very, very long days, perhaps, and definitely not a long negotiation, considering you are actually organising a parliament.
Yeah, pretty much. That's right. Considering you are talking about the future of a country, it's not very long. And I think everybody's very aware of that, you know. You want to do it well, because if you do it badly, crikey.
Is this the result you wanted heading into negotiations?
Look, the Right Honourable Winston Peters said right at the start to the New Zealand First Caucus, we must put all our own biases outside the door. We must focus on policy and make sure that we treat each side equally. Which is exactly what we did. So at the end of the day, because I hadn't had a one-on-one relationship or conversation with Jerry Brownlee or Bill English, so I didn't have any preconceived idea about who they were as people. And I have to say, you know, I was pleasantly surprised that all, you know, the majority of people in Parliament, they're good, decent, honest people who just want the best for the country. So the conversations were respectful on both sides, and it just ended up that policy with the Labor Party won out.
And in terms of ministerial positions, are these the positions most suited to the New Zealand First ministers?
Well, for myself, I it's an incredibly big learning curve because obviously I guess when the Prime Minister rang me on the weekend before the coalition agreement was finally made public and asked me to take this portfolio, knowing that this was something that was really, really special to her, she was passionate about it, I had never considered taking this portfolio. So that was a shock, but I guess I was quite honoured that she felt that something this important she wanted to offer to me, to ask me whether I'd consider taking it. So whether it's a good fit or not, I guess the public will have to tell, the people will have to tell, once I've really got my head around this and make sure that I do the best inside this portfolio for children. Internal affairs I hadn't considered either, but, you know, Chris Hipkins is the Minister of Education and I'm sure he'll be a great one.
The national standards being abolished, how did that come around?
Well, that was a shared policy. I mean, it was part of the conversation that New Zealand First and New Zealand First had both with the National Party and with the Labor Party. But, you know, it won't be a surprise to anybody if they went and had had a look at New Zealand First's education policy and the Labor Party's education policy, that we were both on the same page there.
And back to you again, sorry. With the change in terms of the name for the Oranga Tamariki, where did that come from?
Well, actually, I don't know because I haven't made any announcement. So it was reported in, I think, on Stuff that I had made an announcement that the name would change. I've made no announcements. I've been sitting in this chair. Look, I've been appointed the Minister for Children. So I understand that perhaps there's been an assumption downstream that immediately we were going to make a name change. And I'm not saying that there won't be going forward, but I just thought it was really interesting that it was announced and stuff that I had made an announcement when I can categorically tell you I've made no announcement.
Thank you for clearing that up, actually.
That's right.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to any sort of developments on those announcements. But in regards to the waka jumping policy, could you explain that a bit more? Because there's been some questions around that.
So I think it was 2005. New Zealand First, and the last time that New Zealand First and Labor were actually part of a coalition we were actually supplying confidence then, there was a waka jumping bill put in, but it had a sunset clause in it. Now, the purpose of the bill is to recognise that there are MPs like myself, list MPs. I have not been voted in here by an electorate. A group of, you know, Rodney decided that they wanted Mark Mitchell to represent them as their electorate MP. I am here based off the vote of the people who voted for New Zealand First, the party and the policy. If I decide I don't want to follow the rules of the party or follow the policies of the party, then I don't have a mandate to be here. because people didn't vote for me particularly. So so the Walker jumping bill is to recognise that that is the case for a List MP. And if I'm not going to follow, if I want to cross the floor and not follow the policies that were campaigned on by New Zealand First, then I need to leave the Parliament. So that's really what this is about, recognising that List MPs are here